Welcome to the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast, where we go inside what makes a coach a coach.
My idol growing up was John Lucas. I'm watching him as a young kid and watching him at the University of Maryland. And then as fate would have it, I ended up going to Duke, and his family, his mom and dad, Mr. and Mrs. Lucas, took me in to make sure that I was looked after when I was down in Durham, North Carolina, where he was from.
The Guardians of the Game podcast is a production of the National Association of Basketball Coaches and Learfield IMG College, and is brought to you by Wilson Sporting Goods. And now your host, Coach Dave Odom.
Welcome back to the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast, and I'm Dave Odom, and I am really excited about having our guest today. His name is Tommy Amaker. He is in his 12th year as the head basketball coach of the Harvard Crimson Ivy League. I don't know. I've been doing this 3 years now. I don't know that we've ever had an Ivy League coach on here. And what better person, what better coach, what better friend to have than Tommy Amaker? Because he's just been such a great player, a great coach. And he loves the game of basketball. Crane, he's got a great story to tell. I can't wait to talk with him. So, Tommy, welcome to the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast.
Well, Coach, thank you for having me. And it's great to hear your voice. And, you know, you and I go back a long way. So I'm really honored to have a chance to be a part of this with you. So thank you.
Okay. Well, let's get right into it. Now, let's see. You were born in the Northern Virginia area. It was a hotbed of basketball growing up in high school. Summer basketball was at least as big as the winter basketball there. I mean, I remember in some of my recruiting experiences, I'd go up and, you know, look for some of the different leagues, and a lot of it was played outdoors, and some of the names that we all learned to revere played on those hard courts that you guys learned the game on. And you went to Woodson High School. You were coached by the great Red Jenkins. He was a man just revered by everybody as a great coach. Tell us a little bit about growing up in Northern Virginia and your early stages of basketball and how you got interested in it, and Coach Jenkins and the whole scene in D.C. area.
Sure, Coach. I mean, you hit it on the head. I mean, that Washington, D.C., the DMV, as people widely refer to it, you know, more so now than they did before. But being from Northern Virginia, being in the Washington metropolitan area, as you mentioned, you know, basketball in that area, it has always been, you know, very widely, you know, participated in and watched. And you have good schools in the area, so you get, you know, players who are going to be academically, you know, qualified. And then you have outstanding coaches. And it is a basketball town. I mean, you know, the Washington Redskins, through the years, have always been the, you know, the great team there, and people followed it, you know, really passionately. But the sport of basketball, especially at the youth level, was always very popular. And so for me, growing up in that area and wanting to be a part of it was just a no-brainer. And going to camps and things like that, that's how I first met Coach Jenkins. You know, going to the Northern Virginia basketball school that he used to host at George Mason University. And so being a kid, going through camps like that, and then playing in my rec league where I'm from, and in that Falls Church area, the James Lee Rec Center, we had summer teams. And you mentioned something that this doesn't happen today, which I missed as a college coach. And you talked about the summer league. I mean, the Jell-O summer league, the high school Jell-O summer league, I think that you were referring to, was certainly outdoor. And we played in that. And so you had high school teams that played. It wasn't all-star teams. You had your own high school team that played in the summer league. And so your teams were a part of it, and your community stayed through, you know, not just throughout the course of the winter and the regular season of high school, but your community is always wrapped around your high school summer teams as well. And that was a bragging right, an opportunity to follow your team and see the JV players go to varsity, and, you know, you see the growth there. And so it was great. I mean, I was very fortunate and lucky. My mother taught school in that Fairfax County system, you know, so I grew up in a household that, you know, valued education. And a lot of my aunts, my mother was from a big family, and a lot of aunts and her sisters, they all taught school. So, you know, being a kid from a teaching background, you know, just kind of made sense for me to kind of, you know, be a part of sports, to be a part of teams. And then as I've been fortunate enough to be a part of coaching. So I've been blessed, you know, as we all have, coming through with some great people and mentors and coaches and people that have been a part of your life. And certainly that area fosters that kind of environment. And I was very fortunate to have that a part of my life.
Tommy, you were a great player, but there were other great players in that area. You know, just for our listeners, for our young coaches that are listening, you know, throw out some of the names, Billy Bryant, guys like that, Lynn Bias, that grew up in that area and that played in those same Jelliffe leagues and just right. kind of covered the country. I mean, they were the talk of the country at that time.
Well, that as you mentioned, that area, you go back, like you said, Billy Bryant and you know, you had JoJo, I'm thinking of played at Mackin High School, JoJo Hunter, and you mentioned Lynn Bias, who was, you know, playing at, obviously went on to the University of Maryland. The guy right before me was the best player in the area, Johnny Dawkins, who played at Mackin High School in the Washington, you know, the Catholic League, you know, DeMatha was in those leagues. And so you had great teams, great players, I mean, just that came through before me, and, you know, kind of Johnny and I looked up to the guards that were in the area were Sidney Lowe and Derek Wittenberg. You know, those guys were the talk of the area because they played the backcourt. And so we followed all the backcourt guys. And then during my time, Muggsy Bogues from the Baltimore area, a little bit further away, but it all started to kind of, you know, kind of grow together a little bit. And then you had the Dunbar teams of the Baltimore area that came to play in Urban Coalition in Washington, D.C. That was the other summer league. That was a summer league where you actually had the Washington Bullets. This is before the NBA had their own summer league. The Urban Coalition was a big summer league that you had some high school teams and players that played in it. And then you had the older division where you had the pro division where you had the Washington Bullets would always put their free agents and their rookies, and then they would play in the Washington Urban Coalition Summer League at Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C. And I played in that. And, you know, I mean, Coach, you know, I mean, it was just so much in terms of summer basketball that, you know, that we had access to, and you had a chance to lucky enough to participate. And then if you went to college, you know, when you came home, you know, you had the Georgetown Kenner League, you know, so that became the Coalition and the Kenner League. And then Georgetown had their, which still exists today, is the Kenner League right at Georgetown University. And so you had all these, you know, leagues, you had all these amazing players, and then you had tremendous coaches for their respective high schools in the area that, you know, it was just right there. And we were all lucky enough to, one, to participate in, and two, learn from and watch the other wonderful talents and players that, you know, that came through. And then, you know, after my time, then you're talking about guys like Grant Hill and Danny Ferry and, you know, I mean, so.
Billy,
you know,
King, them, David Robinson.
Billy King. I mean, the list goes on and on. I mean, that's exactly right. And so it was just, you know, what could be better than that, you know, for high school, you know, younger basketball, and then have a chance to watch, you know, some of the older players and learn from them and then see them play in college. You know, Coach, my idol growing up, I went to the University of Maryland basketball camp as a youngster as well. And my idol growing up was John Lucas.
Oh, boy.
And so I'm watching him as a young kid and watching him at the University of Maryland. And then as fate would have it, I ended up going to Duke, and his family, his mom and dad, Mr. and Mrs. Lucas, took me in to make sure that I was looked after when I was down in Durham, North Carolina, where he was from, where he played at Hillside High School. So, I mean, all of that, you know, started from my youth time at summer camps, you know. As a matter of fact, when I was John Lucas would speak at the Northern, speak at Coach Red Jenkins' camp over at George Mason, and instead of taking a salary because of I had grown up idolizing him and got to know him, and he took me, you know, like was an amazing thing for me as a young kid that he would take me under his wing and look after me a little bit. And when he would speak at the camp, he would say instead of taking a fee, he would say, "Hey, let the little Tommy go to another session of camp for free instead of me getting a check." You know, so I mean, you think of all those days and those times and how blessed you were, and then sometimes how life can come full circle for me now. I went down to Duke and then played in his hometown, and his mom and dad kind of took me in when I was down there. I mean, crazy stuff, but all because of, as you know, and you've been a part of it in so many special ways too. All because of basketball. I mean, it's amazing what the game has been able to do for a lot of us and all of us who have participated in it and like to think been good to the game. And the game has been exceptionally well to all of us in so many ways that you can't even imagine. And so I was very, very lucky.
I'm sitting here thinking, Jeepers, all of those names and all of those experiences that you just named. I mean, it was like we were all a part of the growth of basketball back in those days, and it was just happening before our very eyes. And I'm sitting here thinking, you know, today you've got people in the what they call the grassroots of basketball, and they spend all this time trying to get great players together. And I promise you, the teams that they call the best teams in America today couldn't hold a candle to some of the teams that were naturally put together, like the Dunbar team that you mentioned in Baltimore. Now, between you and I, you think we can name the starting lineup on that team even today? I mean, you get two of them right off.
I think we can go with Muggsy, Wingate, Reggie Williams, and I think Reggie Lewis didn't start, right?
No, he was the sixth man. We got one more.
Yeah. Herman Harid.
Yeah. There you go.
Herman Harid. That's right.
That was the best team in the country.
They were the best team in the country. I mean, by far. And, I mean, just went through everybody, went undefeated. We haven't even started yet to talk about five-star. You know?
No. Oh, my gosh.
I mean, which was another piece and level where you went to that camp, you know, you weren't on your high school teams and stuff, so you did that. But then the one camp that you actually, you know, had to go to was five star. And
yeah.
Certainly that's, you know, that brought my relationship and association with you.
I know.
Going all the way back to five star. And I know you were a part of the very beginning of that with Mr. Garf. And I mean, we haven't even touched that yet. I mean, but those were, you're talking about the days of that kind of basketball that I think we all are indebted to. I'm not trying to speak for you, but I can't imagine that you wouldn't feel the same. We were indebted to those types of events and moments that have helped shape us and the relationships that you end up building, just like mine with you. I mean, I've known you forever and recruited by you and still till this day, you don't want me to, but still to this day, I still call you coach. I still call you Coach Odom. You know that. So, I mean, that means a lot to me and how I feel about you and how far back we go.
You know, you mentioned five-star, and, you know, what a wonderful 12, 14 years that I had there. When the NCAA ruled that we college coaches could no longer work five-star camp in the summertime, for whatever reason, I had kept a record of the number of weeks that I had worked five-star. And there were, like, five different sites, but the two that were – most dominant was Robert Morris in Pittsburgh and the one up in Honesdale, Pennsylvania. Those were the two. But there were other sites, Hampton, Sydney, and Radford. And, you know, we worked all around. But when they ruled it, I could no longer work it. And the last day of the last camp that I was able to work, I went up to Howard Garfinkel, he and Will Klein had run the camp and still owned the camp all these years. And I walked up to him and I said, Garf, this is it. I got to walk out of here. I'll never walk back in here as a camp staff member again. He said, I know. And I said, I want to tell you something. I said, I've kept record of the number of weeks that you've allowed me to work here. And he said, what was it? I said, it was 55 weeks.
Unbelievable. 55 weeks. Unbelievable.
Over a year of my life I spent in that camp. Yeah. I did. And you know what is? You can imagine what his comment back to me was. That's it?
That's it?
You don't have one more for me? Give me one more.
He probably didn't miss a beat when he did.
Oh, no. He expected us to stay right on in spite of the
That's
NCAA.
Right.
All right,
That's
look,
right.
We got to move along. We could talk about that forever, but I want to mention your recruitment. I'm at the University of Virginia at that time, and I tell Terry Holland, who was the head coach, I said, look, there's this great guard up at W.T. Woodson, Red Jenkins. I know Tommy. I know his family. I know Coach. We're in great shape. We go up in there. We do a great job. I think we can get him. And so it was a Sunday afternoon. I'll never forget it, and nice and warm, and we drive up, and we got this big SUV deal that Terry's driving at that time. And we pull up there and we go in there. And I said, look, now, this kid can really play. And he says, I said, I understand we got Othell Wilson. I understand we got Ricky Stokes, but these guys are going to be seniors, and we're going to need another lead guard the next year. So let's make sure Tommy knows. So we go in there, and he, you know, if Terry Holland has a fault, it's that he's too honest. And I knew when he went in there with Red Jenkins and your mom and you sitting in there, and he said, "Now you probably won't get much time your first year, because we got Ricky Stokes and we got Othell Wilson." My head snapped around at him like, "What are you saying?" In that van, and I tore off the armrest and everything. I said, "Terry, what are you saying? You can't." He said, "Well, I had to be honest about it." Well, of course, the story's told. You know, you quickly committed to Duke, and you tormented us for 4 years.
No, Coach. It worked out for everybody, as you know, and obviously with Othell and the other perimeter. You know, with Carlisle, you guys were loaded on the perimeter. That put those guys as seniors, and but I remember that, and you know, obviously you. You know, your recruitment of me and your relationship that we had, you know, I always loved that. And I knew how much, you know, you had built up that rapport. But it worked out the best for everybody. And I love the fact that Ricky and I, you know, as you probably know, Ricky and I have become really good friends through the years. And what a great guy he is. I've gotten to know Rick Carlisle through his time as an NBA guy. You know, great. And then the UVA, I mean, what an amazing place. I mean, I being from the state of Virginia, we always knew, obviously, how great that institution was and is. And, you know, just to have a chance to, you know, to be associated and recruited by you guys was such an honor. But, no, for me and Coach Jenkins, that was one of the things that he was really, you know, hot on is where did he see me going as an opportunity, you know, the way it was laid out personnel-wise. Where he thought that I could play. And I relied on him as, the resource for me to think about basketball, where this thing could work and how it would fit. And it fit the right way for me with Duke. And I always remember this, too. You know, I mean, Coach K was, as you know, during those times, I mean, it was rocky. And it was, you know, it was touch and go a little bit of whether or not how things were going to go for him as a coach at Duke. I mean, there was a lot of things swirling around with the – you know, going to be able to turn that thing around and last. And I always remember Coach Jenkins. I don't know if I ever told you this, but Coach Jenkins, after every visit, we would just sit and talk and just kind of, you know, like everybody would evaluate, you know, hey, what'd you think? How'd you like this? This sounds good, blah, blah, blah. Just kind of go back and forth. And I always remember him after the Duke visit, you know, he said to me, he said, "Tommy, I know there's a lot of things, you know, about, you know, Mike Krzyzewski, you know, thinking that maybe is this thing going to work out for him?" He said, "But I'll tell you what," he said, "I'm telling you right now, I got a great feeling about this guy." And I just said, okay. So, and I always teased him about, I said, you know, I said, "Coach, last time you had that damn feeling," I said, it turned out to be like you knocked it right out of the box. I said, "I need one of those feelings like when I can go to Vegas or play the lottery." Yeah. I said, "I need one of those kind of feelings you had back then," you know. But my time being recruited by you and Coach Holland and Coach Drizelle at Maryland. I mean, you know, I actually took a visit down to Wake Forest with Coach Tasty and Coach Freidinger and Coach Nestor. You know, I mean, all these guys that, you know, your contemporaries and colleagues at that time. And I mean, you know, when we talked about my senior year, it was kind of referred to as around the country as the year of the guard. I mean, you had Keith Gatlin, you had Muggsy Bogue, Kenny Smith, who I know, you know, you guys at UVA were hot on at the time as well. You talked about Corey Gaines out in California, Curtis Aiken, I think, was out of Buffalo. I mean, just guard Thompson, you know, from out of Michigan, Antoine Joubert. I mean, you had a whole list of guards that kind of came out that year, and it was just a bunch of, you know, backcourt players. That people were, you know, running around recruiting or chasing or whatever. And look where kind of guys that kind of, you know, panned out and where they went. But, you know, I was real lucky to have options and be recruited by you and others. And I was very fortunate that, you know, I made the decision that I made, which fit me very well and turned out well for everybody.
Let's talk about just for a minute, because it's painful for me to listen to it. But let's talk about your early days, and then your developing days at Duke. I mean, you ended up being coached by Mike Krzyzewski, who, as you just mentioned, he was a developing young coach at the time, not proven like he is today. I mean, that's almost heresy to say, but it's true. But you were also blessed to be playing with a group of players, Jay Billis, Mike Allery, Johnny Dawkins, who ends up being National Player of the Year, David Henderson, Tommy Amaker. All you guys were kind of there at the same time, and you grew and you helped grow this thing that we call Duke basketball. You were the guys that seeded that at the time.
Yes. You know, Coach, that's a great way of saying it, seeded it. And, you know, as I've been in part of coaching now and have taken over programs, and as you've done the same thing through your tenure and your illustrious career as a fantastic coach, you know, one of the first things that I've learned, and I look back now my time at Duke, you know, that how we were able to do this at Duke, was trying to establish an identity, you know, for your program, an identity of how you're going to play. You need to be able to establish that so you can build toward that, recruit toward that, sell that, and believe in that. And I think that's one of the things that I know when I first got there at Duke, my freshman year, I knew that's what Coach was trying to – he really wanted to play a way in terms of playing pressure man-to-man defense. And he one of the things that he instilled and made me believe in was that, you know, he needed or wanted me to kind of be one of those backcourt players for me to come in and play with Johnny Dawkins and be a backcourt that could really get after people defensively. And that was what he wanted to do and how he wanted to play. I thought that my greatest attribute, you know, to helping Duke basketball was that right there, was I thought I was able to allow him to coach in the way he wanted to coach. And then we end up kind of, you know, taking off. But it was because of, I think, of my time being here at Harvard. I look back at my time at Duke and trying to say, how did we go about doing it at Duke and what some of the things I could do at Harvard to help me here. And I always remember, like, I thought that Coach K did it. He did it with defense and he did it with Duke. So he was like, he was going to play a certain way defensively, a certain style. And then he was going to utilize all the pieces and the resources and the layers of what the Duke institution, the Duke brand, could do. And you really didn't use the term brand back then, but use Duke, you know, as the school. Well, we've done the same thing at Harvard, you know, and so similar to what you said about how we stayed together. And we talk about how fortunate, you know, we all were, you know, in particular he was, you know, didn't have anybody that had any, you know, major injuries. I mean, we weren't a very, you know, deep team. I mean, you think about all, you know, guys going down, you know, today and different times. And I mean, what if Johnny Dawkins goes down, you know, with some kind of injury or something that kept him out? I mean, I just can't even imagine how things would have, you know, have turned out and how lucky you have to be. But that was the time with Billis, Allery, Henderson, Johnny, and myself. You know, we kind of became that core group. And they were ahead of me, 1 year ahead of me, as the number one recruiting class when they were there. And then they were freshmen, and they, you know, took their lumps their first year. And then I came in the following year. My first year was 83-84. And I thought, you know, you kind of feel like, you know what, I really feel like at times now as a coach, you need players or certain players that can help everybody else get a line right. I thought that I was one of those guys. I came in and we moved Johnny off the ball a little bit. So now he's aligned better for what he really is wired to do, which is to score. And he could do it like the best with anybody. And went on to become the all-time leading scorer, you know, in the history of Duke basketball. So, you know, J.J. Redick broke it, but he was that player. And I was able to come in and kind of handle the ball and play defense and try to quarterback the team. And I thought that looking at it now, and Coach would even say it, you know, me coming in kind of moved everybody, tweaked everything a little bit enough to where everybody kind of got aligned correctly. And that allowed us to kind of grow together. And in today's times, you don't see, you know, teams staying together for 4 years like that. And then we went on and, you know, we're very lucky to, you know, kind of make a run and became his first NCAA tournament team my freshman year. And then went on to have a Final Four run my junior year when all those guys were seniors. And so that kind of became, you know, the growth. And then another piece to it, Coach, that, you know, people don't really kind of associate with and talk about, but that was kind of the convergence and the emergence of ESPN basketball. So the rise of Duke basketball was very fortunate and lucky that it happened to be at the same time that college basketball took off on ESPN. And then here we come as one of those teams that was swept right up in it. And we got exposure and recruiting. And so, you know, it's timing, luck, you know, and hopefully being a little bit good too.
Well, you know, one of the things going on now down at Duke is, and you hear a lot of the ESPN guys kind of promote this, is that maybe the guy that they can do least without is Trey Jones, who is reputedly to be the best defensive guard in the country. I think you were as well early on, but you were rewarded with, in 1987, you were the NABC Defensive Player of the Year. When you look at a guy like Trey Jones, do you see a little bit of yourself there? You're talking about the brand. I mean, you kind of established the brand for being a great defensive player in the backcourt. Now you got a guy like Trey Jones there who's everybody's saying is maybe the best defensive guard in the country.
Yeah, I think he is too, Coach. He's sensational. And you know, like when I was fortunate enough to get, you know, hell, they had to give it to somebody that year when they just started it. So I think it landed my way somehow. But that was the beginning, as I said, that was the beginning of establishing the identity, you know, of Duke basketball. And as you mentioned, I has grown, and Coach being the best at, you know, in the business of, you know, continuing a certain culture and branding of things, and how others have gone on. And you had Billy King after me, and Grant Hill, and Wojciechowski, and Shane Battier, and I mean, all these guys became, you know, National Defensive Players of the Year. And that's been a big part, you know, of the Duke program. And then you see what you're talking about with Trey Jones. I mean, coaches referred to him as, you know, their most important player. You know, he talked a lot about that, you know, maybe during my time, as not the best player, you know, not the most talented guy or the best player or leading scorer, any of that. But he always, you know, talked about, you know, the importance of certain guys. And you see that a lot with the kid Jones right now, because, again, I use that word a lot, the word alignment. I think when he's there, everybody else is aligned well and aligned properly. You have one key piece or one important person out. Now everybody's trying to do a little bit more to make up for it, and stretching this way and that way. And people need to, you know, and sometimes it works and most times it doesn't. But he's that key guy, I think, and how he sets the tone and sets the culture for the program and what they believe in, and what has made Duke basketball under Coach K so significant is that he's prided it on that ability to defend. And it starts in his mind, his system, in most places, you know, it starts with that guard out top, you know, that can set the tone for you.
I want to quickly move on if I can. I know you had a couple of really good offers that you decided to stay at Duke as an assistant, grow a little bit, get more experienced, more savvy. But then Seton Hall came along, offered you a job. It was 1997, as I remember, and you stayed there for 3 or 4 years. You went to 3 NITs, an NCAA, overall record 68-55. You took the job at Michigan. Michigan at the time is not the Michigan that we know today. They were going through some tough times from an NCAA standpoint. You went in there and cleaned that up. That had to be difficult. You know, because you're taking over for other people, but you carved out 108 wins and 84 losses. Went to some NITs. I think we actually played you.
You beat our butts in one of them. That's exactly right.
Well,
that was 2006, Coach. You beat our butts in the NIT championship game. Absolutely.
Yeah, it was one of those things. You know, I remember kind of looking down at you one time, and you're looking at me like, "What's up?" I said, "I don't know. Our team's just playing lights out." But anyway, you did some great things at Michigan to get that cleared up. And I know John Beilein would give you a lot of credit for that now. But I want to move into the Harvard era. I mean, you've been there now. This is your 12th year, and you know, you've been to the NCAA tournament 4 times. You've won 6 Ivy League championships. Tell us about the life of an Ivy coach. I mean, you play on Fridays and Saturdays. You got to turn it quick. You travel in pairs. That is, two schools going and play. Tell us about the life of being an Ivy coach.
Yeah, coach. I mean, you went through some of the stops along the way, and you know, just takes me back down memory lane there for a second with those other places, Duke, Seton Hall in Michigan, and as you know, you've done it as well as anybody ever. You know how hard it is that, you know, when you're changing and moving and taking over and you know, starting over and building and growing, how much that takes and the energy that it takes. And you know, being here now, I can't believe it. It's 12 years being at Harvard, and you know, it is a unique model. You know, one that I've gotten to really, really appreciate the perspective that we have, and we play on Fridays and Saturdays in league play after January 1 because of the philosophy of trying not to miss as much class time. You know, that's been the history of this league, is to play back-to-back Fridays and Saturdays. And so you would, if you're away, you would miss Friday classes, but you do play Friday, Saturdays, and that's it for the week. And that's challenging to get prepared for throughout the whole week. You know, we've been able to try to find a rhythm that works for us and what days to take off and how to manage that and how to get prepared for, you know, for two opponents back-to-back, and some can be similar and some can be drastically different. So, you know, the challenges are there to get ready for two games. And you know, we bust to, you know, to our opponent's place. And, you know, and we don't travel with, you know, our quote-unquote partner, which is Dartmouth. But, if you play certain games, if for instance, say if we're playing at Penn and Princeton, we would play, you know, Princeton on Friday, and then Dartmouth would play Penn on Friday, and then we would flip-flop. You know, they would go and play there at one of those places, and we play the other one, and then we would flop in terms of playing the other opponent. But you have Penn and Princeton, Harvard and Dartmouth, Brown and Yale, Cornell and Columbia. You know, so those are kind of the quote-unquote partners, but we don't, you know, necessarily, you know, we're not together when we go to those places to play, but we swap the next night each other. And so the perspective is always of, you know, of the thought of a true student athlete. And not that other places don't believe in that. I mean, they're just ways in which they're going to be, we're not going to, you know, make any compromises in that. And I don't mean that in a such a negative way about the word compromise, but we're not going to play our games during the week just because of TV. You know, that we can get on TV on a Wednesday night to play a conference game because it would be nationally televised. You know, that's just the decisions that are made within our conference that Fridays and Saturdays. We just went to an Ivy League tournament, you know, which we were the last conference in the country not to have a conference tournament. We believed in just playing the regular season, and then the champion of the regular season would go on and represent the conference in the NCAA tournament. Well, now we've added a conference tournament, which would be a top four seeds in our league would now participate in a tournament, and that winner would represent the league in the NCAA tournament. So, things have grown, things have changed, but the league itself has a certain perspective, and we like to think of our model, Coach, and it's different than the other models of, say, the Power Five. We like to say the model for the Ivy League is more of the amateurism model and not so much more the commercialism model that other leagues may have, and it's not like one is right and wrong or better or worse. It's just that's just who we are, what we believe in. And it's a lot of tradition in this league with these schools. You know, here at Harvard, we're the oldest school in the country. You know, school was founded in 1636. You know, so this place goes back a long ways, and then certain things that are beliefs and ways in which we go about it. We don't get scholarships. You know, everything in the Ivy League is makes it very hard to recruit. But everything is what we refer to as need-based financial aid. If you need the money to go to one of our schools, if you need the money to go to Harvard and you get in, then we'll give it to you. But if you don't need it, and there's a way that they go through all that with, you know, applying for financial aid and determining how much, you know, we would be willing to give based on, you know, whatever your household income may be. But, you know, those are some of the things. And so it makes it a little challenging at times to recruit against, you know, a situation where a kid can go to, say, Vanderbilt for a full scholarship, and, you know, we say he can come to Harvard and have to pay X amount of dollars per year. Well, that's a hard sell. even though it's Harvard and, you know, other great schools out there, and you can go to one of those places for free, you know, that's a big difference there, a big gap. And so that's probably a big piece of the puzzle for us, as always is for everything and everybody, is money. But, you know, we have a brand here and a situation here that we believe in, and we've been able to present it to the right folks, and they've been attracted to it, and we've been lucky enough to get some really neat kids to come here and help us win, and we've had a lot of fun doing it. And that's one of the things I love about where I am is that, you know what, we have great kids and we have fun with them. Not that they still can be, you know, 20 to 21-year-old kids and all the same things usually apply, but we do think that, you know, we're having fun coaching and teaching and seeing these kids go on and do pretty neat things on and off the court. Pretty exciting for me.
Tommy, last thing. You're on the NABC Board of Directors. That's important. That's an important position. It's an important board because it gives coaches direction. I'd like to ask you, when you look at the state of college basketball today, it seems to me the calendar is shrinking. I mean, it starts in November, and, you kind of get through November, then you got December, you got college football, you got NFL football. Students go home, there are no students around over Christmas. Still, you got games going on. You got this one-and-done deal that everybody's dealing with now. Now we got a fifth-year transfer thing that's going on. How is the NABC Board of Directors dealing with all this? What are your personal feelings about it? When you get through with that, we're going to wrap it up and let you get back to your team.
Yeah, Coach, well, thank you. I am on the board and proud of that. And as you mentioned, there are a lot of layers and different pieces to the puzzle, you know, for our game. And that's always been the case, but it certainly seems like, you know, this day and age, there's so many more, antennas or tentacles, if you will, that, you know, are affecting, you know, the sport of college basketball. The growth of it, conference realignment, I think, was a huge piece to things a few years back, and who knows if that's, you know, that's probably going to continue and tweak here and there, but that was a big issue, you know, where teams are moving to and being a part of certain leagues and certainly a part of, you know, money. You talk about the fifth year, guys who are, you know, graduating from certain schools and then going to play their final year of eligibility at other places. That's been a sore spot for a lot of folks in some ways because of being able to look at players that, you know, they're going to graduate early and then have, you know, eligibility somewhere else. Transfer in itself, you know, the kids have to sit out, you know, or kids getting waivers and just a lot of pieces to our game. But I think the leadership at this time is critical, you know, for us as coaches to, in NABC with Jim Haney, as you mentioned earlier, and to be absolutely on board with, you know, ways in which our game is going. You mentioned one and done with the NBA and the G League now and so many pieces now of how that's going to change. And I think things are changing with the new commission, you know, that has been kind of formulated, you know, through some of the ills that we've seen recently going on in our sport. So I think, Coach, in the next 3 to 5 years, in my opinion, I think there's going to be a lot of different ways in which you're going to view college basketball. I think rules are being tweaked. Rules are being evaluated. I think the one-and-done effect is, I think it's going to go away. Who knows how soon or fast, but I think that's happening. It's in the process. And so I think things are moving in a really good direction, and I honestly believe that. I think we have more people that are willing to make some changes and see how we need to update and grow how we govern our sport, basically how the times are changing, technology, kids, the way the world works. Has all kind of changed, and we need to constantly kind of upgrade and change with the times. And I think you're seeing a movement toward that. So I think in 3 to 5 years, I think you're going to see some things that are going to allow our game to kind of settle and find its own way in a new direction, in a very positive direction.
Well, I want to thank everyone for tuning in to this edition of the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast, and especially to Coach Tommy Amaker, head coach of the Harvard Crimson. Boy, I tell you, it's been an informative, it's been a fun 30 minutes, actually more than that. I hope everybody's enjoyed that. And Tom, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you carving out some time away from your team to help us. We've probably got a lot of fans out there that are going to be interested in following Ivy basketball, and particularly Harvard basketball here over the next year or so. So to anyone that is interested in learning more about the NABC, all they have to do is visit the NABC.com. You can get all the information. Thanks again, Tom. You're a real champion and a real friend. Thanks for being with us.
Coach, thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.